Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Mayor-elect Marty Walsh is expected to announce a transition team tomorrow before leaving on a short vacation. Walsh's victory on Tuesday was due in large part to a broad coalition of community activists and politicians, as well as labor leaders and rank-and-file union members.
Much of that labor support came in the way of big money and also thousands of volunteers who knocked on doors, many of them from out of state. Joining us is Terry O'Sullivan. He's the president of the Laborers International Union of North America. He was in Boston rallying for Walsh during the final moments of his successful mayoral campaign. And Terry O'Sullivan, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Love to hear your response to Marty Walsh's victory this week.
It was inspirational. I mean, obviously, we're proud. Marty, as a proud member of the Laborers International Union, as a member of the building trades. But what was most inspirational is his whole campaign was about being positive. He didn't go negative. And he built a coalition like we haven't seen in a long time. It was a broad-based coalition. And when we had the rally the other night at the Strand Theater, it was great to see people from different creeds, colors, backgrounds, all there to support Marty as the next mayor of Boston.
Let me ask you about the significance of Marty Walsh's victory for the union movement. The union movement has suffered some electoral losses recently, most notably in Wisconsin. It lost a recall effort against Governor Scott Walker there, and in California, where a union-backed candidate for mayor of Los Angeles was badly defeated. So given that background, how significant is Walsh's win for the labor movement?
I do think, Anthony, that it's significant for the people of Boston. And I do think it is significant for the labor movement. Here's one of our own, who I might add was a great candidate, who happened to be a labor representative, that is going to, you know, is for One Boston. I think this gives us some lift. It certainly gives us hope that somebody from a union background can aspire and succeed in becoming the next mayor of Boston. So we're proud of him. We're proud of the campaign that he ran. His history as a state legislator, as his history as a trade union representative speak for themselves. Tom Menino was a great mayor, and we think Marty Walsh is going to be a great mayor as well.
Why did your union and other labor-backed PACs choose to invest so much effort, feet-on-the-ground effort, but also money in Boston's mayoral race? Why is this so important?
Boston is a great union city. It's a strong union city. It, unfortunately, there's not that many of those anymore. Mm-hmm. Not enough of them, that's for sure. And so not only because he was a proud trade unionist, a proud laborer, but Boston is significant in the labor movement. In the strength of our labor movement starts in, I won't say ends in Boston, but we want to make sure that Boston stays strong, that it stays a good union city, that it stays as a city that welcomes everybody. And that's why we invested significant resources in Marty's election.
Terry O'Sullivan, as you know, one of the charges against Marty Walsh made by his opponent, John Connolly, was that if elected because of his close union ties, he wouldn't be tough enough in negotiating with the unions on behalf of the city. Respond to that. Was that a fair charge?
No, it's not. I think it was an insult to Marty professionally and personally. Marty Walsh, his record speaks for itself. He's going to be a tough mayor. He's going to be a fair mayor, and he's not going to play favoritism. Mm.
But is it fair to ask that, you know, Walsh has spent a lot of his career working in the union movement with this victory on Tuesday, which was helped in a big way by the union movement? What do unions expect in return for that support?
A mayor that's going to be fair, and that's what Marty Walsh will be. His mm-hmm. whole career is about being fair and inclusive. That's what we expect. We know that's what we're going to get in Marty Walsh. Mm-hmm. You know, there's mayors and governors across this country that are out to destroy the labor movement, not to treat them fairly. And all we're asking for is to be treated fairly. We know we're going to get that with Marty Walsh.
Let me ask you about a specific issue, which you've probably heard about. The police union in Boston has recently been awarded what some say is a very generous contract through arbitration. Critics call it too generous. How do you think Mayor Walsh will or should deal with the police union?
You know, I don't think I can comment about, I know the issue, but I don't know all the specifics, nor do I have a real grasp of the raise itself. And I know there's people on both sides of the issue. I mean, I think Marty will treat the police department just like he will everybody else. He'll sit down, he'll roll his sleeves up, he'll be fair, he'll be open, and he'll be honest. And I don't think you can ask for any more than that.
Mm-hmm. Last question. What other races is your union and other national unions focusing on as we move forward across the country? Give us a sense of sort of the landscape out there that you're taking a look at and figuring out where to throw your weight behind.
A lot of battleground states, Ohio governor's race. We have somebody who's running in Michigan for governor that happens to be a laborer as well. And so we're going to be focusing on battleground states, governor's races, and we're obviously going to be focused on the midterm elections next year, House of Representatives and the Senate. So next year is a big year, pivotal year. We're going to be spending significant resources and mobilizing our activists around mostly battleground states, governor's races, and House and Senate races.
Well, that's Terry O'Sullivan. He's president of the Laborers International Union of North America. He was talking about his support for Boston Mayor-elect Marty Walsh in the campaign that just ended this week. Terry O'Sullivan, thanks so much for talking to us. We're very grateful.
Red Sox last week, Marty Walsh this week. So thanks again for having me.
All right, it was our pleasure.
Leader, 22 News at 6.
Should the state put an end to bilingual education? An effort to put the question before voters is in the works. Good evening. And welcome.
A little piece of newsreel there to take us back to 2002 when Massachusetts voters passed a ballot question requiring English-only instruction in the state's public schools. The law essentially made it illegal to teach English language learners in their native languages. But the number of non-English speakers has been growing. They're about a third of the student population in Boston's public schools. And they consistently have the lowest MCAS scores and the highest dropout rates. However, there is a new effort underway to change that. WBUR's Asma Khalid joins us now with more. Hi there, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
So, first of all, what is the state doing in this new effort?
Well, they've launched this big initiative, actually, this year, to train essentially every teacher who has even one English language learner in their classroom. That includes about 30,000 teachers. Obviously, they cannot all be trained at the same time, so they're rolling it out this school year, and the plan is over the next 4 years, they will train all these teachers. And it's kind of, you know, an interesting mix of what they're learning. They go to these courses after the regular school day. I did attend one class in Malden where a teacher was handing out these bilingual pamphlets in foreign languages to the teachers, some in Chinese, Portuguese, and the teachers were expected to use their context clues to figure out what these pamphlets mean. And the idea was, you know, step into their shoes.
Oh, to see how the students
exactly
feel.
Exactly. Right. And the teacher in that classroom that I went to, her name is Jennifer McCabe in Malden. Let's take a bit of a listen to her.
And what happens oftentimes, we're always like, shh, stop talking. You might think that the ELL student is just chit-chatting with their peer. However, oftentimes they're trying to increase their comprehension. They're using their partner as a scaffold, and they're trying to increase their knowledge of what's going on. And that's why we ask teachers to let the students talk to each other. Try to lessen the teacher talk, okay?
So, you know, Meghna, you heard there, some of this may sound like common sense. I've heard that from some of the teachers that, you know, a lot of this is just a reminder that culturally, you know, some students may not understand simple things like the need to line up for lunch, you know, sort of cultural things that are happening in the school. And this is not only the idea that, you know, we have to focus on bringing in academic English into the classroom, but also cultural sensitivity.
Mm. Now, Asma, in the introduction to this conversation, we talked about the consistently low MCAS scores that English language learners have and the high dropout rates. Were those the major motivations behind this new effort, or were there also other issues?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. You know, it's not entirely a grand goodwill gesture by the state's Department of Education. You mentioned 2002. That's when English immersion became the law of the land here in Massachusetts. And in 2011, the Federal Department of Justice stepped in and said that the state had been violating students' rights under the Equal Educational Opportunities Act because they had not actually developed a curriculum to teach this English immersion. And they also had not required teachers to be trained. So this teacher training is a direct byproduct of condemnation from the Department of Justice.
Okay, so since we're talking about when all this happened in 2002, one of the main arguments back then for those who were in support of the ballot measure was that English immersion would actually deal with historically low performance from non-English speaking students.
That is true, and that is a very fair point. I think, you know, Massachusetts was the first state in the country to have a bilingual educational system. It had been here operating for many years, and it was not successful. And so a number of people, you know, bilingual educators in the state felt like, you know, we have to try something else. And what I have heard from a number of people, you know, is not saying that we should go back to a bilingual educational system either, but they feel that this is a one-size-fits-all strategy, and it doesn't work. You know, a kid coming to the United States in kindergarten it's much easier for that student to learn English than somebody who comes to the United States in the 10th grade and being put into an only English classroom.
Okay, so tell me then how this new teacher training really gets to that one-size-fits-all problem. Is it terribly different from what we have already?
I don't think that it is. Essentially, it's trying to equip teachers. So say you're an algebra teacher and your job in the past might have been just to teach kids, you know, the quadratic equation and whatnot. But now your job is also to infuse those lessons with English vocab. And so you're teaching them sort of basic, you know, sequencing words. First, I do this. Second, I do this. And the idea is that by infusing English vocab into all classrooms, kids will learn English better.
WBUR's Asma Khalid. Asma, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And I should let listeners know that Asma has more on this story regarding the problems and attempts to solve them with all English immersion in Massachusetts public schools. That'll be on Morning Edition tomorrow.
And stay with us. Up next, the story of a U.S. Marine aviator lost during World War II and a 21st soldier's mission to bring him home. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.